Friday morning, everyone. It is the first week of July, and it's roll-up time. David, you ready to dig in?
I am ready to dig in to the Friday weekly roll-ups, the best episode in all of crypto, at least I think. This is where we go through what's happened in the last week of crypto. We go through the markets, what's happened in the markets. We go through the releases, what got released, and then we go through what's happened in the news cycle. And then we finish off with who had some interesting takes in the crypto ecosystem, and then we finish things off with what David and Ryan are excited about. And then we finish that off with the meme of the week.
Still not finished until the meme of the week comes. Then you know it's over. All right, man, you ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do it, Ryan.
All right, before we do, we got to talk about Kyber's Rainmaker program going on. They are making it rain, KNC tokens. This is their long-awaited liquidity mining program that they've just launched. 25 million over the next 3 months. They are dishing out to liquidity providers. We've got ETH, USDC pairs, wrapped Bitcoin pairs, DAI pairs, everything. And across two chains, not one chain, two chains, Ethereum two chains. And Polygon. That's pretty cool. Love that Kyber's doing this. They are an OG DeFi protocol. So click on the link in the show notes if you want to learn more about how you can supply liquidity and start earning some of that rain yourself.
Kyber is one of the oldest projects in DeFi, and they are in the capital efficiency game with their dynamic market maker, which changes fees according to market conditions to make sure that you are optimized in your LP position. So check that out.
David wanted to fit the words capital efficiency in. I know you did, David. You wrote a fantastic article on that. David, let's start market time, man. Let's start with Bitcoin price. What is Bitcoin price doing for us? I'm going to scroll out to the 5 day and see where we started. I think that was like the third or something.
Yeah, we started at $35,000, fell down to $32,700. Then we jumped to $36,000. Then we dumped to $32,000. And now we're at $32,800. So flat on the week, basically where flat we started. But also did jump up a little bit. It is nice to have a pretty high in the middle of the week, even though we didn't end there. It's nice to claim some of that high territory, which I'd say.
Yeah, good Wednesday. We had a good hump day.
We had a good Wednesday.
Yeah, good Wednesday.
There was a hump on the hump day. Nice.
Do you know what, though? I feel like Bitcoin's in maybe a bit of a rut. I don't know if you feel this way. It's coming off of Bitcoin Miami, we had the El Salvador news that kind of spiked things a little bit, but that's sort of died down, right? Mm-hmm. People aren't really excited. And I'm talking narratives, of course, here, not fundamentals. But the halving is behind us, too. Michael Saylor putting Bitcoin on your corporate balance sheet, that hasn't quite spread like wildfire, right? Where the Bitcoin bulls were saying it would maybe in January of this year. Any takes there? Do you feel like Bitcoin's in a rut too? And how does it get out of this rut?
Yeah, I'm sure Michael Saylor would like a few more allies than he thought that he would have gotten by now. But at the same time, I think Bitcoiners will say that the halving event doesn't manifest in the price until like 2 years later, right? That is like what the halving is, apparently. And so they always
stock
will say,
to flow, right?
Yeah, stock to flow, right? If you believe in that. And so when I talked to my Bitcoiner co-host over at POV Crypto, CK, he talked about how, like, you know, it's going to take the world a while to integrate the El Salvador news into their understanding of Bitcoin. And so, like, the price appreciation happens later, right? There's always a lag, which sounds both true. If we look at the historical evidence of Bitcoin, the catalysts always appear in the charts later, but there's also, like, you can also say that that's just an excuse, you know, if the markets integrate everything in the moment of, and so, you know, who knows? But yeah, like, unlike Ethereum, which has like a bunch of positive tailwinds coming its way, Bitcoin just kind of feels like floating out at sea. Like, where's it going to go next? We don't really
know. Yeah, there's not another happening for a while, right? What is the next catalyst? That remains to be seen. But let's
Taproot, let me tell you that.
It's not? Okay. All right. Let's talk about Ether for a second. So price of Ether, where are we now? Where did we start?
Yeah, we started the week at $2,170, dipped down to $2,000. Then we jumped to $2,400, which got everyone really excited. And now we are back down to literally exactly where we started at $2,170.
There's some good news about this, David, and that is ETH is at an all-time low on exchanges, like a 2.5-year low. So people are pulling their Ether from exchanges. This is awesome. This is great for banklessness because it means they're either holding it, privately, self-sovereignly, which is awesome, or they're using it in some sort of a DeFi protocol. Maybe they're trading it on Uniswap or providing liquidity on something like Kyber rather than hold it inside a crypto bank. So I feel like this is pretty bullish. It also probably means, David, they're not exiting or not planning to exit to fiat, which is another good sign. Any takes here?
Yeah, the ETH on exchange metric is always interesting. When there's low ETH on exchanges, that always means that like price can be volatile, and people generally think it's volatile to the upside, just because like if there's no ETH to sell because the ETH isn't on the exchange, so there's only people who can buy ETH who want to buy it. And if there are people that want to buy it because there's not a lot of ETH on exchanges, it moves the price faster to the upside. Granted, DeFi is also a place to buy and sell ETH, right? So a lot of ETH could be moving off of the exchanges and going into DeFi to be sold on Uniswap. So it's not necessarily that there isn't ETH available to sell. It's just not, like you said, it's not available to sell to go back to people's bank accounts. So this is a bearish metric for people who are thinking that people are trading their ETH, like you said, to go to fiat. However, you could still trade your ETH and go to crypto dollars, but that stays in the Ethereum
ecosystem. You can go to crypto dollars, and crypto dollars to me feels also somewhat temporary, or at least it is net positive for Ether, right? You're still using those transaction fees on Ethereum. You're still using DeFi. Let's take a look at some of this ETH. It's definitely going into staking. Beacon Chain deposit contract. Dude, happy 6 million, man.
6 million in the deposit contract. That's great.
There's over 6 million Ether in the deposit contract right now. So I guess like the quick math on that is what? It's just over 6% of all ETH supply.
A little bit less.
Yes, a little bit less.
Yeah, because there's roughly 117 million Ether and there's 6 million Ether in the deposit contract.
Right. So a little bit less. So, I mean, super impressive though. I mean, do you remember the discussions we were having in like winter or late fall of 2020? It's like, oh, is anyone going to put their
deposit?
It's a one-way bridge. It's a one-way bridge, fam.
What was the threshold we needed? Half a million?
Yeah, half a million.
Like, are we going to be able to make it? Are we going to be able to get half a million Ether? These were the questions we were asking.
I think we made it. I think it's okay. It's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that ETH Bitcoin ratio. What's that doing? So I'm seeing some ups, I'm seeing some downs, but more ups than downs.
In the last week, you're seeing up, man. And that's really the story. I think the ETH BTC ratio tells a bigger story than the ETH dollar or Bitcoin dollar.
The biggest story, maybe the roll-ups.
Yeah, and the same story is also being told, we're going to get to this, on the ETH DPI ratio, which is also looking just like the ETH BTC ratio. We are establishing this floor at 0.055 ETH per BTC, and we could definitely range between where we are now at 0.065 and 0.55. Like, there's definitely room to bounce back and forth here. But what the story that I am seeing is that when it does hit that 0.055 level, it rockets back up. Maybe not rocket, but it's got a very solid foundation floor at 0.055, which again is historically a high ETH BTC valuation. And so when I see Ether hitting 0.055 and just rejecting it and going back up, that's indicating to me that people are still risk on. This is a in my opinion, a great proxy for overall the bull market. If you want to ask the question, is the bull market over? I think you should look to the ETH BTC ratio because that tells the story.
You know, David, I think you're spitting a lot of wisdom here, man, because especially we're just talking about the, you know, Bitcoin price in a rut. The doldrums, no tailwinds ahead in terms of narrative for Bitcoin that we can see in the future. But there are a ton of tailwinds ahead for Ether. We're going to talk about some of those when we get to kind of the news and some of our takes on that. But like EIP 1559, the merge, all of these things are going to be tailwinds for ETH. So if we're going to have a continuance of the bull run, we need ETH to run.
Yep.
And we need this ratio to continue going in the direction
it's
going.
Evan Van Ness will happily say that Ether and Ethereum always leads bull markets. And so when we see the ETH BTC ratio rising, that's where we get to say is like, oh, this bull market is still looking good.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's talk about other bull market indicators. Mm-hmm. Value locked in DeFi. So that's been hanging
slightly up.
Slightly up a little bit. So $55 billion of value locked in DeFi, hanging in the 50s or so. Not too bad. Let's talk about DeFi tokens as measured by the DPI, the DeFi Pulse Index, which we talk about every week. So a little bit up on that.
Up on the week. Up on the week. Yeah.
DeFi tokens were catching a bid this week.
Mm-hmm. We started at $260 to start the week, ended at $300, but also hit a midweek high again on Wednesday, hump day, of $350. And so I think we should go ahead and go right into the ETH DPI conversation, Ryan.
You've been waiting for this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Look at that number. Look at that 0.13. Okay. So I called the bottom at 0.13. It broke down below 0.13 for a solid like 8, 9, 10 days. But
And you said, to be fair, you said, give it 2 weeks. If it doesn't break for 2 weeks, that's what you said two weekly roll-ups ago, then you're still in the clear. So you're still feeling okay.
It's not, I will admit that I did not call the absolute bottom. So like, I guess if you want to be really strict about this and say the number fell below 0.13, yes, the number fell below 0.13. So I did
not
call the
absolute. Part of me wants to be strict on this, David, but I'll give you some grace too.
Yeah, well, okay. So like, let's think about things in 6 months, in 2022. Say, for example, that DeFi tokens finally get the bids that they deserve and DPI resurges back to previous levels and maybe even goes on the bull market that we've all been wanting the DeFi tokens to go on the bull market for, and they break previous cycles, then what are you going to say? Like, oh, David didn't call the bottom of 0.13 because it was 0.12, even though DPI is at 0.3 or something. Like, it's going to be a great bottom call.
I'd also say, so if this bull run turns into like ash and sadness, right? And we're ranging in this, you know, 2000 or so range for ETH. Mm-hmm. I'd also give Eric Conner some credit for calling like 2,500 ETH.
That's a fair point.
Because he kind of deserves that because it shot up above, but not for too long.
Right.
So like the spirit of the prediction is intact. So David, the spirit of your prediction is intact.
And that's what's important.
But we'll see for now. We'll see what happens. No, Every week we're going to be checking up on you.
That is a really good point, I think, about Eric's top call. If, for those that aren't following, Eric Conner made the top call of $2,500 for ETH price. Then we rocketed above that to $4,300, making Eric wrong. But we have spent a lot of time below $2,500 even in contrast to how much time we spent above it, right? And so like while the call was technically wrong, the more and more time we spend below that number, the more and more Eric is in the spirit of things correct, which makes me really angry. And so I really would like ETH price to get it back above 2,500 so I can start gloating against Eric Conner again.
There you go. We could do that anyway. All right, let's talk about this. You know, this is a metric I wanted to include in metrics, David, because NFT bear market is what people are saying. Ain't no bear market.
Apparently, that's just a meme. That's just a thing that people say.
It is. It's a thing that people say because look at this. OpenSea volume. So this is like kind of an eBay, let's say, for NFTs, where all of the NFTs are being sold on kind of secondary markets. Best volume ever in June. Best volume ever. Yep. 150 million in volume.
Higher
than the peak of the mania. So
quote unquote NFTs, mania, yeah.
Like there are some categories of NFTs that are down, like you know, Top Shots, maybe a few other categories, but there are others that are up. And in aggregate, ain't no bear market here. NFTs are still plowing ahead full steam.
I think that just makes sense. I think when people are saying, oh, there's an NFT bear market, what they are really saying is like, oh, my NFTs are down. I'm no longer getting really rich really quickly on NFTs. Like this random NFT project that I just aped into didn't make me any money. Like, yes, that side of NFTs is in a bear market. There are some NFT projects that are going to zero just because the market didn't want them. NFTs as a whole, NFTs as an industry, doing just fine. And so there's definitely a consolidation to quality going on in the NFT market. And we are seeing that play out.
But this makes sense too, right? If you think about like collectibles, which collectibles are in style, you know, 90K for 90s kids, it was like Pogs, right? And then it's like at one point in time, it was like Beanie Babies. And all
I
of
do
these
not
things.
Remember Pogs. I never figured out what Pogs are.
You didn't know what Pogs are. Okay. So like some of you guys listening remember Pogs. And like, anyway, collectibles as a whole has not gone down, but individual collectibles and categories of collectibles have had their cycles. Maybe NFTs are starting to reflect some of that. Anyway, David, we are going to get to releases, but before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
Balancer is a powerful platform for flexible automated market makers.
Typical AMMs just have two tokens inside of one liquidity pool, which can lead to fractured liquidity across the many pairs in DeFi. With Balancer, you can access the full power of multiple tokens inside of one single AMM, which unlocks an entirely new playing field of possibility. This makes Balancer an awesome building block for so many different use cases. Balancer pools can make asset indices, but instead of paying fees to portfolio managers, Balancer lets you collect the fees from traders who use your portfolio for liquidity. Additionally, Balancer smart pools can be programmed to have properties that change according to predetermined rules, such as changing the swap fee based on market conditions, or even liquidity bootstrapping pools, which can help you launch and distribute your token with day one liquidity. At Bankless, we use a liquidity bootstrapping pool to sell our BAP t-shirts to much success. Balancer V2 brings powerful new features that makes your money work even harder for you. In V2, idle tokens are capable of generating yield in DeFi without sacrificing liquidity in the pool using Balancer's asset managers. Balancer's vault architecture lets you trade between Balancer pools at a fraction of the cost versus trading on other platforms. Balancer's mission is to become the primary source of liquidity in DeFi by providing the most flexible and powerful platform for asset management and decentralized exchange. Dive into the Balancer pools at app.balancer.fi. Gemini is the world's most trusted cryptocurrency exchange. I've been a customer of Gemini since I first got into crypto in 2017, and it's been my main exchange of choice to make my crypto buys and sells. Gemini is available in all 50 states and in over 50 countries worldwide, and on Gemini there are markets for over 30 various different crypto assets, including many of the hot DeFi tokens, and it's one of the few exchanges that has liquid DAI markets. Gemini just launched their Earn program, where you can earn up to 7.4% interest on 26 various crypto assets. If you're tired of paying fees in DeFi, or you don't want to worry about DeFi exploits, but you still want to earn interest on your crypto assets, Gemini Earn is the product for you. Another product I'm stoked to get my hands on is the Gemini Crypto Back Credit Card, which gives you 3% cash back on all of your purchases, but paid to you in your preferred crypto asset. When I get my Gemini credit card, I'm going to make sure that I get my cash back in ETH, so whenever I buy something, I get a little bit of ETH bonus back to me at the same time. You can open up a free account in under 3 minutes at gemini.com/gobankless. And if you trade more than $100 within the first 30 days after sign up, you'll be gifted a free $15 Bitcoin bonus. Check them out at gemini.com/gobankless.
All right, guys, we are back with releases. David, this is an almost release, but it still counts because we've
release
got to talk
of
about
a release.
It. It's a release of a release. It's a release date, which is super exciting for EIP 1559. We're
What's
talking
that?
About.
I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, you're about to hear about it then, sir. August 4th is the date. Mm-hmm. August 4th. So that is going to be maybe an Ethereum holiday in the future. I don't know. It's a really exciting milestone for Ethereum and Tim Baco, who is kind of the, I guess, coordinating lead mm-hmm. for this EIP, has been shepherding
for Ethereum 1, actually, as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he has confirmed this. So it's merged. It's in GitHub. The date is merged. The go live date is set. So unless something big happens between right. now and August 4th, looks like August 4th is going to be the day for EIP 1559, which includes the new gas transaction auction mechanism and also the Ether burn. Super exciting, man, to have a date finally.
Yeah. And granted, asterisk, if something goes wrong on the test nets, then it will get kicked out. But if nothing goes wrong, then it's going to be the fourth. That's basically the two paths that we have forward with us. It's really awesome to have a date, August 4th. Like, holy shit, that's so cool. It's so close. Bankless and ETHUB are going to do a live stream. We are talking with Anthony and Eric to get that going. So there will be an EIP.
No matter what time of day.
No matter what time of day.
Whatever.
We woke up at 4 a.m. to do the ETH 2.0 Beacon Chain launch live stream. And there's no other time that we couldn't do if we wouldn't do 4 a.m. So whenever that's happening, there's going to be a live stream. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, we'll be there. This is cool. This makes it real too, is when you start to see Etherscan showing the fee burn. Look at this at the top here.
This is on the Gorli testnet, by the way. Yeah.
Gorli testnet. Really, yep. But in Gorli testnet, and by the way, everything's going well in Gorli testnet, it seems like. Mm-hmm. There is a fee burn of over 80 ETH so far. Of course, results will be totally different in right. mainnet, but it's so cool to see that on Etherscan. You can also see, get this, David, mm-hmm. on Etherscan, you can see on the transaction, like an overview of the transaction, you can actually see the transaction fee savings, which I think what this calculates is what you maybe would have paid before versus so, what you're paying now. Is that what it's calculating or what is this?
So I think what's going on here is that with EIP 1559, you can set how much you are willing to pay and then you will pay the base fee. And that's kind of like saying, just like how you are when you go into MetaMask, when you want to do a custom gas transaction, if you want to really tinker with your gas and make it specific, say you want to prioritize your transaction. So gas is at 50 and you want your transaction to go in ASAP. So you put in 70 and then you overpay by roughly 20 Gwei if your transactions would have otherwise gotten included for 50. With EIP 1559, you can put in 70. But if base fee is 50 or the right payment is 50, then you are not paying that extra 20. You are paying 50. And so this is reporting to you is like, hey, you bid up to this amount, but you actually paid this amount. So this is how much you saved. And this is actually where a lot of the confusion about EIP 1559 reducing gas costs came from. If EIP 1559 does reduce gas costs, it's from reducing the cognitive load of users who have to think about the right price to put in their transaction and also perhaps getting that number wrong. So that's where if there's any fee savings, it's coming at the human brain level, not at the protocol level.
But that human brain level shouldn't be underestimated, right? Because like if you're bidding like 70 on that transaction and I get the inkling that you're bidding 70, I'm going to bid 71, 72, and it just kind of escalates in a very rapid fashion. That's how the mechanism kind of incense people to just keep outbidding one another. Totally. In this model, it doesn't matter, right? Like, because you'll get the savings back anyway. Super cool.
So just to be clear, EIP 1559 does not save gas fees at the protocol level. It makes gas fees easier to reason about, and that allows you to make more precise choices about how you spend your gas, which can cause you to spend less gas.
And it also burns that sweet E.
And also burns it.
We didn't talk about that. All right, let's talk about this. This is the Beacon book, David. Super cool. This is kind of an NFT, an actual physical book. This almost looks, to me like an almanac of some sorts. You know, after a team like wins a sports championship, like the World Series, they'll publish a book. It'll be quotes from the MVPs, all of the players on the team. That's kind of what this reminds me of, only it's for the developers of Ethereum 2 and the Beacon Chain. All of these researchers that have been hard at work bringing this thing to market, this kind of commemorates them. Super cool.
Yeah, this is led by Trent Van Epps and other contributors to the Stateful Works project, which is producing the Beacon book. This is an actual book. You can go and read it. It's online. It's just it's a wall of text, but you can actually produce a physical book and purchase a physical book if you want to compete for one of those. They're going to be in high demand. This is how would I want to describe this? This is like a timestamp of Ethereum progress and development, right? This is going to the Ethereum developers, the actual protocol of Ethereum, people who work at client teams, people who work at the EF, and they talk about their experience of building out Ethereum, right? This is going to be a one-of-a-kind piece of this art or book or illustration. It's free for you to read, but purchasing a physical copy is an NFT, so that there's going to be competition for that. But this is really just instantiating a lot of just blood, sweat, and tears of the Ethereum developers, the Ethereum builders, to get Ethereum to where it is today. So Trent and the Stateful Works team have done a fantastic job just honoring all of the labor of the Ethereum developers that they have put into Ethereum over the last 6 years into the Beacon book. And so go ahead and check it out. Go give it a read. Get your learn on. This will be a great learning moment. And then if you want to compete for some of the NFTs and some of the actual physical books, go right ahead.
Absolutely. Collect a piece of Ethereum history. David, let's talk a little bit about Polygon. This is part of kind of the Layer 2 Summer. I know Polygon is a side chain, but Layer 2 Summer, nonetheless, kind of a test ramp for all of the Layer 2s that are coming out. Balancer joins Polygon with a $10 million joint token incentive program. This is kind of what we're talking about with Layer 2 Summer, where you have protocol plus the Layer 2 itself rewarding users and incenting them to deposit liquidity into their protocol on Layer 2.
Dual yield farming is hot. So if you are bullish on BAL and you are bullish on Matic, you can go and get liquidity incentives using Balancer on Polygon. So congratulations to Balancer for launching on Polygon. I'm sure that they are also probably going to be building on Arbitrum and Optimism too. And so maybe we also see some BAL rewards over there as well.
You know what's cool is this is starting to get all of the infrastructure. I remember probably just a couple of years ago when it hit me that, oh my God, all of DeFi is going to have to re-architect itself right. on layer two. And like what a lift that would take. Right. But you know what, David? It's happening. Right. And it's happening much more incrementally than I thought it would. Here is mm-hmm. Zapper now supporting Balancer Labs on 0x on Polygon. So you could just zap into a position the same way you would on mainnet now on Polygon, which is super cool. This is Dune Analytics integrating with Polygon. And the same recipe, the same playbook of that they're pulling off on Polygon, that's going to take place in the other notable layer twos like Optimism and Arbitrum. And it's going to happen really fast mm-hmm. from this point on. So it's great to see that infrastructure support pouring in as well.
And we have to see that infrastructure report. Infrastructure being built out on these L2s, because like it's one thing if the apps are there, but like the infrastructure is crucial. Like I think people underestimate how important infrastructure is. Using Matic before there was a Polygon scan, the fork of Ether scan was kind of like using a black box. Like if your transaction did something weird, it was impossible to go and check out what happened to it without Polygon scan. And so getting all of these like classic infrastructure tools up and running for all these L2s is really going to be what makes and breaks an L2. You need the infrastructure to go along with you. That's also why Optimism has been more slow to launch versus Arbitrum, just because they are just really dotting their I's and crossing their T's to make sure that they have the infrastructure to go along with all the apps at the same time. So when Optimism rolls out, it should come with a suite of infrastructure. So it really emulates the experience of using Ethereum at the base layer on Optimism on day one.
That infrastructure, man, really provides such a moat for the EVM as well, right? Totally. So if you're launching a layer two or even a layer one, EVM support just gets you some of that infrastructure right out of the box. Totally. David, let's talk a bit more about this. Like the distinction between sidechain and layer two we've made before, but what about the distinction between a sidechain and a testnet? We're just talking about Gourley testnet, mm-hmm. of course. This is a testnet for Ethereum mainnet. This is where EIP 1559 is running and the London hard fork is running. But this from Andre, my mm-hmm. friend Andre, formerly YFI, you know, DeFi builder extraordinaire. In some of the newest stuff that he's built, he actually added support for Gourley testnet. Okay. So like the DeFi products he's building, like in addition to other layer twos and sidechains and Ethereum mainnet, he's also adding Gourley testnet as an option. But what that does, David, is that makes Gourley not a testnet anymore, because it makes the Gourley ETH, Go ETH it's called, makes it valuable potentially. Right. What's that distribution like? Man, people used to like, I have some somewhere, I think, unless it kind of expired or disappeared, I'm not sure. But like a ton of developers have this Go ETH, and it kind of clouds the difference between a testnet and a sidechain if there's actual economic value attached to some of these Go ETH tokens. Any takes on this?
Yeah, my gut take is this is weird, and I don't understand why they're doing this. But Andre and then also Bantag from Yearn, they're both like bullish on this. They're both excited about it. They both think that Gourley could be an L2 scaling solution to Ethereum. It sounds like they know more than me. And so let me asterisk what I'm about to say with saying that they might just straight up be more informed about what this could be. But Gourley is an Ethereum fork, right? It's a clone of Ethereum that's meant to be an Ethereum testnet. It's not any more scaled than Ethereum itself, to my knowledge. And if it is, it's scaled in the same way Binance Smart Chain is scaled, which is just tinkering with some numbers that really shouldn't be tinkered with. And the reason why you can tinker it with that on Gourley is because it's a testnet. There's nothing at stake. If it explodes, it doesn't matter because it's a testnet. In my opinion, testnets should be testnets. And there's terrible Gourley ETH distribution. I'm pretty sure there's like two people that have like more than 50 or two addresses that have like more than 50% Gourley ETH, or there's some like terrible distribution of that. If you're starting to use Gourley ETH as money, or as some valuable asset, the distribution of Gourley ETH becomes really important. And it was never meant to be money. It was never meant to be distributed. So that it's become very concentrated. I'm skeptical of using testnets as L2s. Testnets are testnets. L2s are L2s.
It just makes it a different thing, right? And right. I think mm-hmm. this is why some of the people, like developers of Ethereum, particularly who have testnet deployments, are kind of pissed off about this. Because it kind of ruins the testnet. I mean, right. like... Are you going to, how incented are you going to be now to give your goat ETH to someone who's just testing something out, right? If it has economic value.
Are we going to start doing like Go ETH improvement proposals now?
Like... Yeah, exactly. So what it kind of does is it, it makes it a different thing than what it was. So if you make Goerli testnet an incentivized sidechain system, then you just need a new testnet.
Right.
We have to go create another testnet. Yeah. And I think people are angry about this because
I would like some further analysis on this from people who are more privy to these conversations,
but also you can't stop it, right?
Can't stop it.
Like once it starts, you can't stop it. So we'll have to talk about this as it emerges a bit more. Aave Pro coming in July. David, we did an episode, State of the Nation, with Robert Lesher on this, all about institutions coming to DeFi. This is the DeFi mullet thesis.
No.
Your take on this.
DeFi coming to institutions.
Ah, yes.
Important distinction.
Yeah. So what is this? Aave Pro seems like kind of like Compound Treasury.
Yep. Yeah. So it's the same Aave that we know and love, same thing with Compound Treasuries, same compound that we know and love. There's just a new interface or a new wrapper around the whole protocol that is, institution friendly, right? And so with Compound Treasury and with Aave Pro, they solve a lot of just like the issues of using DeFi that we all know exist. Like private keys are scary. Like once you get used to them, they're not, but initially they are, right? And also you need to have certain compliance and reporting requirements. Well, if you just make a wrapper around Aave and make a clone of Aave, a fork of Aave that uses Aave as the protocol, but only allows certain whitelisted players or certain entities in there who need that sort of control and allow them to use that wrapped version of Aave, protected Aave, if you will, that is, and then again, it hooks into Aave underneath the actual Aave protocol that we are all using.
It's DeFi with training wheels.
DeFi with training wheels. Yep. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A little bit of a bubble boy DeFi, which is fine. That's what the institutions are familiar with. And the fact that we're seeing this in Aave and Compound at the same time is actually really interesting. Kind of tells you the rate of progress in this industry. Like if we also saw this with L2s, like. It just so happens that Optimism and Arbitrum are releasing both in July. Like, funny coincidence, Aave Pro and Compound Treasury are also releasing around the same time. The rate of change, the rate of progress is like breakneck speeds because these teams keep on releasing the same products around the same time. Anyways, the story is that DeFi is becoming institution ready. And we are not waiting. We're not waiting on our hands for institutions to learn how to manage their private keys. We're just figuring out how to solve that problem for them and making it easier for them to come to us. So DeFi is building the bridge to institutions rather than institutions having to build the bridge to DeFi. And that's just how Ethereum works. Ethereum just solves its own problems. It's really cool, really optimistic story.
This is also going to bring a ton of liquidity, right? A ton of like value from institutions. And you know what I love about this too, David, is like, it's the in this banking system, it's the institutions who need the training wheels, not the retail investors. Yeah. We can use the power tools at will if we want. I feel like the traditional banking system is the complete opposite.
Right.
The institutions get the better banking system and they give all of us retail consumers the training wheel version of the thing.
That's an interesting take. Like Robinhood is just finance with training wheels on it, and then here is, retail, dude. Have Robinhood. Here's what you get.
The way they front run you alone, sure, right? Yeah, like Robinhood, that's their business model. No fees, retail, but we're going to front run every trade, and you don't actually see that cost there. Anyway, let's talk about some raises this week. The first is this Index Co-op, the DAO. Just raised $7.7 million from Galaxy Ventures, 1KX, a few other VC companies. Super cool, I think, that like a native DAO is now raising from VCs, right? It started off without any outside VC investors, but now outside investors want to jump aboard this. I think that's kind of cool.
It is cool. And the other thing that's cool is that there is a 1 year lockup on these index tokens with 6 months linear vesting. And the price that they got them at was pretty competitive. Usually when organizations like with not too much liquidity on their tokens, try and sell their token. They give them a pretty good discount. There was not much of a discount on the index tokens being sold to these into these investors. And so I believe, if I'm regurgitating this from Anthony Cezzano, which I do happen to do a lot. They were sold for roughly $24.50 a piece, where index token is currently trading at $27. And I don't know when these tokens were purchased.
Do you know what's cool about this too, David, is that like retail had an opportunity to buy index co-op tokens before all of the VCs for months.
I did.
I love it. Right. Yeah. And like, and then here the VCs have to get kind of our table scraps.
Yep.
It's kind of nice. Yep. Again, training wheels.
Yeah. If you've been paying attention to Bankless, if you've been paying attention to DeFi, like you cannot have missed index co-op. Index co-op is one of those tokens that I never feel like not financial advice, blah, blah, blah. But like, I'm just super bullish on index. It's like the DAO is super greased. Like it works. Yeah, it's had a fantastic product. It's got tons of revenue. Now it's finally getting the attention it deserves from larger firms. I'm bullish on index, man.
Bullish on index, bullish on DAOs in general, yep. Bullish on this kind of capital coordination. Super cool. All right. Also, Zerion raised $8.2 million in a Series A fund. Just a great DeFi dashboard. Zerion is fantastic. It's kind of a user interface. It's like a banking interface on top of all these DeFi protocols. I love what those guys are doing too. Are you ready for news, David?
Let's do it.
All right, let's get to the news. Hey, we got to start with a bank, JP Morgan. They say Ethereum upgrades could jumpstart $40 billion staking industry. So they're saying Ethereum, ETH2, Beacon Chain, that's going to jumpstart a $40 billion staking industry. It's like, yeah, guys, we've been telling you this, but like, cool.
Hey, you guys
better start learning Solidity.
Oh man. Well,
I mean, the banks are saying it though now, right?
Better late than never. Yeah. Yeah. If the banks are saying it, you know, it's like, oh yeah, this is starting to really breach into the mainstream.
Do you know why they're saying it too? Look, so the first bank, this is a Swiss bank called Signum. Thank you. Wow. I butchered that. Signum Bank is offering ETH2 staking services, right? So this is super cool because it is the first time a bank, a registered financial bank institution in the jurisdiction of Switzerland, is offering a staking service. And this is recognition that Ether is, as we've been saying, an internet bond. This is going to deliver yields to people. This is not my favorite way to stake, of course, right? Because this requires that you give this bank custody of your private keys. Although you can dictate a separate withdrawal contract. So there might be some intricacies where you just give them kind of validating rights. I'm not sure how this is configured, how this is set up. What's cool, I think, is that the banks are coming aboard. And if Ether is going to be a global reserve asset, which we think it will, if Ether is going to be an internet bond for the world, a non-sovereign bond competing with sovereign debt type instruments and bonds, this kind of thing needs to happen. So it's starting, man. This is domino one, and the rest are going to fall. JP Morgan report, this bank is now coming to staking. How soon until JP Morgan wants to start offering staking? Of course, important that we can still stake at home and we don't have to use that non-sovereign we don't have to give up our sovereignty and our private keys to a bank, but still they're coming along for the ride. It's kind of cool.
And this is the beauty of staking, is that like any entity, because you can stake at home, any entity can therefore stake, right? This isn't mining. You don't need to have like privileged access to supply chains or just be interested in a multi-million-dollar investment to a mining operation. All you need is one computer to stake, and then banks can stake, you know, funds can stake. Anyone can stake. Anyone can make a staking product. So that
governments
can stake, and that makes staking really, really competitive. And from an Ethereum protocol security perspective, that's really, really good, because you want there to be an extreme amount of competition in the staking world. And so I invite all banks to open up, you know, staking products, staking services, because I want more stake to happen, because that makes Ethereum more secure, and it's also bullish for Ether. And so this is one of the many little tiny little flags blowing in the wind that say, hey, Ether is going to become the world's internet bond. And it starts with just competitive staking and many different things with many, many different ways. But one of the ways it starts is competitive staking across the globe.
Yep. Absolutely. David, let's talk about this. Andre, the creator of YFI and the YEarn ecosystem, he's on a tear again. I feel like it's back. I feel like this is why this is in the news section. It's because Andre is back and he is building. So these are a few things he's built. LevX is one. Protection markets, some sort of on-chain insurance, Aave Delegate. Like, he's just like pushing stuff out. There's about five or six things here that he's pushed out and into GitHub. And you know, one of DeFi's biggest builders is back, maybe from a brief break or hiatus, or what's your take on this?
Yeah, and this actually isn't all of the entire list of what he's built. He also released another project on his own Medium that he announced as well. People are stoked that Andre is building again. There's some mixed opinions on this because whenever Andre was building something right after Yearn, it attracted all the attention. It actually kind of pissed Andre off. And then Andre kind of like went quiet just because he didn't enjoy being the person that's like, oh, Andre's building. What's he building next? What am I going to ape into next? What's the next YFI? And so he looks like he's just releasing a bunch of prototypes, a bunch of code. It looks like it also is just infrastructure for other prototypes. These aren't going to be tokenized projects.
None of these have tokens.
None of these have tokens. Yeah. And so maybe that's kind of what Andre does nowadays, is helps just build in little attachments or little add-ons to already existing projects. I don't really know. The day that Andre does build a project with a token is going to be an interesting one, if he even decides to do that or not. Maybe he's lost the taste for it.
We should have him on again, David. That's what we should do. Now that he's back, we should have him on Bankless again. It's been about a year.
It has been about a year. Yeah, you're right.
David, let's talk NFT world. So Axie is on an absolute tear. Look at this revenue.
Yep.
Pretty
up
crazy.
Up and to the right.
Axie Infinity. What are people doing with Axie?
Axie Infinity is kind of like a Pokemon game, but with on-chain scarcity mechanisms built in. So you raise and breed little Axie creatures, and then you make them fight.
Which, to the death?
I mean, to the metaphorical death. I think I'm pretty sure you get it years back. You level them up. Each one has different properties. And people are really, they have been one of those, I wouldn't say dormant, but, you know, kind of heads down building projects with a very committed community fan-based following that would play this game. But it has absolutely taken off in the last like maybe 2-3 weeks or so, broken into the absolute like mainstream news cycle of crypto. We are actually bringing Jiho on the State of the Nation next week on Tuesday to talk all about Axie Infinity and the explosion of growth that they've seen in the last 2 weeks. So if you are interested in this story, we will be reporting on it on the State of the Nation on Tuesday.
Here's the meme term to remember. You ready?
Ready for it.
Play to earn.
Play to earn.
That's what's happening in Axie. And I think this is a model that is just beginning, that crypto game studios are really pioneering. I expect to see a lot more. I expect to see more from like even Gods Unchained in the future around that. All right, David, Bitcoin world, there's really not too much to talk about this week. All is quiet in Bitcoin land. So let's hop over to regulation. China's central bank worried that stablecoins pose risk to the financial system. Do you think this is also because it's kind of a USDC? It's the dollar seeping into Chinese markets, and they want to protect the sovereignty of their currency and the reserve currency status of the Chinese, yuan.
It's absolutely that. There's nothing that China wants more than to dethrone the dollar and place the yuan there. And so, of course, they don't want, stable coins to exist, because stable coins are dollars. They're not yuan or yen or whatever. Yuan, thank you. important note. And so this is completely antithetical to what China wants. China doesn't like free markets. China doesn't want, permissionless finance. They want you to use their currency on their rails. And while the U.S. isn't 100% aligned with crypto dollars, and they also kind of want their own CBDC, they are much more cool with stable coins out of the private market than China is.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
You know what's funny is the game theory of this is, if China hates it, I bet the U.S. will start liking it more. Yeah. It's like, oh, stable coins, private stable coins. They're great. Now we don't need a central bank digital currency.
Right.
We'll just privatize it all and export that way.
The private markets built our CBDC for us. Oh, thanks, guys.
Kind of could be, it could go in that direction. Right. So remains to be seen. But there's so much game theory going on about the world reserve currency status, particularly with fiat. Let's talk about this. Ransomware hackers demand 70 million in Bitcoin, and they claim a massive U.S. attack as Biden investigates possible Russian involvement. David, I didn't even catch this story. What is this story talking about?
Yeah, this has been a reoccurring theme over the last few months. There's just been more and more ransomware attacks that have been using Bitcoin as a currency. And so it's an unfortunate PR issue for our industry. I'm not even going to say just Bitcoin, just for crypto at large. Even though all of these attacks have been happening with Bitcoin, people kind of associate it with crypto at large because it is. And so this is going to be a fight that our industry is going to have to tackle head on. And also, there's no reason why this can't happen with crypto dollars or stable coins as well. And so NLW had a really good take on this. Is who do you think is going to get blamed? Do you think Bitcoin is going to get blamed, or do you think Russia is going to get blamed? Probably going to be both, to be honest. But overall, this is an unfortunate reality of the world that we live in. It's a bad PR for our industry, and permissionless finance allows you to do permissionless finance things.
Look, you know, one thing I've learned about politicians, it's they'll blame whoever it's most politically expedient to blame, right? And so one day it might be Russia, the next it might be Bitcoin, depends on what the political aims are going to be. But yeah, it's not great PR, that's for sure.
Especially when Bitcoin doesn't have a single representative to defend itself. It's easy to defend or to attack something that can't defend itself.
Like yeah,
the Bitcoin exactly. Cyber Hornets can yell on Twitter saying, no, this is FUD, but like there's no actual, like Satoshi isn't coming to say like, hey, this is bullshit, don't attack Bitcoin on this one. Like there's no defender.
Also a strength, right.
Uh-huh.
So, double-edged sword there. All right, let's talk about this. Stablecoin firm Circle is going public via a SPAC merger. This is pretty cool.
This is brand new as of this morning. This is a couple hours old. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The numbers are crazy. Look at this. The deal values Circle at $4.5 billion.
Whoa!
We're just talking about stablecoins, right? And USDC is one of the most popular stablecoins. Definitely the most legitimate stablecoins out there. Tether is the only other competitor, but doesn't have the legitimacy that USDC does. And Circle is a primary issuer of that. $4.5 billion. That's a big bet on stablecoins.
Big bet. Yeah. Congrats to Jeremy Allaire and everyone at Circle, and probably also Coinbase is involved with this one as well. USDC just really planting a flag as the de facto crypto dollar, fiat-backed crypto dollar in the ecosystem. Congrats. This is a really, I feel like a monumental moment for the industry. Like there are many monumental moments, but like
it's a mini Coinbase IP.
It's a mini Coinbase IP. Very adds to the legitimacy of the industry.
All right, David, speaking of legitimacy and the industry, America's first legal DAO was approved in Wyoming. Wyoming has been a state that's been very friendly to crypto regulation. And overall, I'm really enthusiastic and like excited about the approach that they've taken. Even recognizing DAOs as a thing is just amazing. So very bullish on that, although not perfect. I read an analysis from a legal Substack, crypto legal Substack that I follow. And there's some weirdness about this, right? So DAOs in this structure cannot be manager managed. So people can't actually be behind it. It has to be algorithmically managed. So that adds some weirdness to it. Yeah, there's some description here, but it just means it's more difficult to have, a centralized institution kind of give up control. It has to be completely decentralized at the start. So there's some issues there. Also, if you're going to do this in Wyoming, you have to put DAO in the name, right?
Okay. All right.
So, like it has to be called something DAO, right? It can't just be bankless. Mm-hmm. It has to be bankless DAO, which is convenient for bankless DAO, I guess. But not so convenient if you're Aave or Uniswap. You don't want to be called Uniswap DAO necessarily.
It also really kills my interest and effort in trying to promote digital organizations or DOOs,
DAOs.
It's not a DAO, it's a DO. But no, apparently I'm giving up on that fight.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Maybe you'll win in the next round. The bill also requires the DAOs to maintain a person, a registered agent in Wyoming. So there still has to be. So again, it's kind of a first draft, right? It's good that Wyoming is doing this, but it's a little ham-fisted on the implementation. Right. Still, no discouragement. Like, kudos, guys. You're actually pushing in the right direction. With some revisions, this could be something really cool. So yeah. We'll look forward to the future.
They're trying. They're trying their best.
They're trying their best.
What I don't like about this is that this is the nation state telling DAOs what they need to do. And the whole point about Ethereum is to not have to do that. DAOs,
I know.
DAOs belong to Ethereum. They owe no homage to any nation state. I guess if they want the perks of being instantiated in a nation state, this is like the coupler.
There should be like a legal coupler. Yes.
This is that a coupler.
There should be a bridge to the nation state. Right. And this is kind of a ham-fisted bridge, but at least it's a bridge.
It's
Do
a
you
bridge.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's something.
I am most bullish on pure DAOs, as in DAOs that exist on Ethereum and Ethereum alone, and the only rules that they abide by are the rules enforced by the EVM. That's the most bankless maxi, the most bankless future. There is absolutely a time and place to be coupled to the real world, and I don't want to discourage anyone from doing that, but like the grand vision of DAOs belongs to Ethereum.
And right now it's going to be a little bit ham-fisted if you try to couple into the real world, yeah. Right? Yeah. It's hard. Okay. A few things we're going to just breeze by, David. The first is this: Visa is crushing it with crypto-linked card usages that top $1 billion. So this is all the Visa cards that crypto banks are issuing, which are cool. Some of these are coming to market, one from Gemini, one from BlockFi. Coinbase is doing something. Crypto.com already has something going. Visa's like, hey, we love it. Yeah. Topping $1 billion. This is working.
Keep it coming.
Bullish. Yeah. David, why don't you do the next one?
Yeah, the Binance squeeze. Barclays customers in the US, Barclays is a bank in the UK, can no longer transfer funds to Binance. Binance, the undomiciled crypto bank, getting the squeeze from nation states. That's all I have to say there.
It's like that vice grip, slow yep. squeeze mm-hmm. rather than a quick hit. Yep. Why don't you do this one too, yeah. David? What's going
Elizabeth
on?
Warren gives the SEC July 28th deadline to, quote, figure out, quote, crypto regulation. Elizabeth Warren has really started to stamp her feet about crypto as an industry. The thoughts behind this is crypto, or Elizabeth Warren is really bullish on a central bank digital currency, and so she wants to diminish the role and of the crypto industry and wants to regulate it in order to, you know, implement her CBDC. Overall, she is really just drumming up a lot of noise about how our industry needs to get regulated, and from what I can tell, she's extremely uninformed about it. I think Elizabeth Warren is a great politician. I think that she does a great job. I overall support her. I have not heard a single good noise out of her as it relates to crypto and the industry that I pay attention to. And so all of a sudden I feel very resonant with the libertarian cohort who just get pissed off at politicians who come in and start regulating other people's industries and other people's businesses while they have no informed position about it. That's what I see happening here.
There's definitely some intent at play here. Yep. And there's a broader plan here. All right, David, before we get into the takes, and we got a lot for the week, a lot of hot takes.
Big takes episode this week.
You're going to love these takes, guys. But before we get to them, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a Uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. The Aave protocol is a decentralized liquidity protocol on Ethereum, which allows users to supply and borrow certain crypto assets. Aave version 2 has a ton of cool features that makes using the Aave protocol even more powerful. With Aave, you can leverage the full power of DeFi money Legos, yield, and composability all in one application. On Aave, there are a ton of assets that you can supply to the protocol in order to gain yield, and all of those same assets can also be borrowed from the protocol if you have supplied collateral.
Here you can see me borrowing 200 USDC against my portfolio of a number of different DeFi tokens in ETH. I'll choose a variable interest rate because it's a lower rate than the stable interest rate option, but I could choose the stable interest rate option if I wanted to lock in that interest rate in permanently. V2 also features the ability for users to swap collateral without having to withdraw their assets, trade them on Uniswap, and then deposit them back into Aave. With Aave, users can do this in one seamless transaction, saving you time and gas costs. Check out the power of Aave at aave.com. That's A-A-V-E.com.
All right, guys, we are back with the takes for the week. Let's start with this one from Chainlink God, who says, a blockchain without oracles is like a computer without the internet. He got the meme correct this time, his words. A blockchain without oracles is like a computer without the internet. What's your thought?
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty cool way to illustrate the role of oracles when it comes to blockchains. Blockchains only know what is true according to their internal state. Ethereum only knows about Ethereum, so it needs oracles to know things about the rest of the world. And so Chainlink God, who is literally the instantiation of bullishness on Chainlink itself, he kind of compares and contrasts this to like, well, if you just have a computer but no internet, the computer only knows things that are on the computer. But if you connect it to the internet, you can Google what is the weather in Argentina or whatever. And so I think that's a pretty cool way to illustrate the role of oracles and blockchains.
Okay, oracles, super important. Agree with you, Chainlink God, on that. What about this take? This is kind of a contrasting take. Or
yeah, here's the yin and the yang. That was the bullish Chainlink. Here's the bearish Chainlink.
Give us the yang. What's going on here?
This Twitter account, which I've never seen before, Edgar Arut says, wake up. Chainlink controlling all information inflow on chain is the worst possible coming dystopia. And then goes through a thread about all the risks of what happens when Ethereum only receives inbound information from Chainlink oracles and Chainlink oracles alone. It's a centralization risk. Like Chainlink is the only thing providing external data to Ethereum. And he goes, indisputable history blockchain plus a gaslit army of zombies calling it fair. I think that's referring to the Chainlink army. And then he also says a private mempool with unverifiable node software. That's the Chainlink infrastructure. And then Edgar says, think more widely than just token prices, which is largely what Chainlink is currently used for. Real estate deeds, oil prices, passage of law, marriage deeds, all funneled and controlled by a tiny cabal with insane power. Again, referring to Chainlink here. And then he kind of goes into the nuances and the critiques of Chainlink in a kind of a nuanced way, which I won't go into on the Bankless Weekly roll up here. But he is saying that there is just too much centralization and consolidation on Oracle power to the Chainlink network, and we need to diversify some of that power outside to other oracles.
Well, I think we should always have some skepticism about oracles, particularly off-chain oracles. This is why I like Ether so much as an asset. Like Ether's price isn't based on anything external, right? We've called it the most trustless form of economic bandwidth for Ethereum, right? Other assets are not like this. Even something like Maker DAO requires an oracle to function. Uniswap is pretty beautiful in that it doesn't require an oracle. I love the sorts of DeFi primitives that like come without and don't require an oracle. So oracle-less design. But with that said, oracles, oh my God, they're super useful for getting all sorts of different, you know, synthetics and DeFi products. And, you know, as this person's saying, real estate deeds, oil prices, commodity prices, all of these things on chain. And so they're useful in the here and now, but they could become a centralization vector. And they are dependent on the degree to which Chainlink is actually decentralized, right? I don't know if I'd prefer to live in a world with many different oracles. I probably would. I'm not sure all of the details of Chainlink's level of centralization versus decentralization. But also, David, there's an element that, look, anything coming off-chain into the blockchain is going to be centralized at some level. Yep. So can you really get around all of these things? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Chainlink is supposed to be a decentralized oracle network, as in like even though there's only one Chainlink network, the participants of the Chainlink network are sufficiently decentralized. Whether that's true in practice is up for debate, and that is the subject of a lot of debate in the Oracle world. I am bullish on all kinds of oracles. MakerDAO just solved their own problem and made their own oracles, and now other people can use those oracles. Compound has hooks into its own network of oracles using both centralized and decentralized options. Coinbase offers oracle services. A lot of exchanges offer oracle services. CoinGecko offers oracle services. The pattern of robustness is that you have redundant and redundant and redundant oracles. And dependence on Chainlink is not redundancy. I want to see competition amongst oracles, and I'm not seeing that. I'm just seeing people just hook into Chainlink over and over and over again.
All right, David, let's take a look at this next take. This is from Balaji. The creator economy is becoming part of the crypto economy, he says, because legacy social media platforms have no real concept of digital property rights. This is a hot take. And he goes on, he talks about Substack, Twitter, Facebook. They're all great, but they are intermediate steps. Ghost goes further. You can run it at a domain that you control. Decentralized media platforms go further still. You hold the private keys. He goes on to make the point that...
Oh, no, like, that third tweet, I think, is really, really important. All right, he finishes up with, under communism, there was no such thing as personal property. Everything that transpired in the PRC and USSR was downstream of that economic illogic, the root cause. The restoration of private property was one of the keys to unlocking the Chinese economy. And Nick Carter wrote an article a while ago, kind of a niche article that didn't really make through the mainstream.
I read it. I love that one.
Which one are you talking
where
about?
Where he talks about like property rights.
Right.
He talks about like, yeah.
The success of developing nations and the economies of nations as it relates to how strong their property rights are. And he made the claim that the stronger the property rights, the more innovation and development is allowed to happen because people have assurances as to the assets that they own. So Ryan, you and I are big on Twitter, big degenerate tweeters. We don't own our Twitter handles, even though we made all the work to produce the value of the content for the people that follow us on Twitter. If we actually owned our own Twitter handles, which we don't, we would have longer, better assurances as to what we could do with our Twitter accounts, and that could blossom into something new. And so this is what Balaji is talking about. He's saying the crypto economy or the creator economy is coming, and with the Web3 world, the world where we own our own social media platforms, there's going to be a blossoming of just like content and innovation and creatorship because people own the land that they are settling on.
I think that's a really good take. Yeah, we are basically renting our Twitter accounts. Yep. Twitter could deactivate us at any time. We can't take the communities with us. They can punish us via algorithm. You too, any social media property that
they
you
did
have.
Did it to a president.
Right. Any social media property you have is rented property, not owned. So it's like building your house on someone else's land, right? And in particular, a faceless corporation's land that has no notion of individual rights. I guess there's a user agreement, but that is not like a charter of freedoms or a bill of rights.
You
in
must sign in order to have that anyways.
Who reads it? Oh my God, how can you read it? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's a great take by Balaji. He follows it up with this take. Why don't you read this?
Yeah, from internet influencer to crypto creator, the internet influencer was forced to rely on legacy media and social media platforms. The crypto creator uses decentralized media to become completely independent from them. This reminds me of just how like there was once three channels and now there are like a million YouTubers, right? Like there used to be this one approved form of information and media, and now there's going to be like a bajillion of them, Bankless being one of them. And that is a take here.
Totally. Everybody can like social media allowed everyone to become Oprah Winfrey if they wanted to, right? It wasn't just like one place to go for that level of influence. But what this also means, David, is all those influencers that the internet has built up over the last 10, 15 years, they're going to find a conduit into crypto and they're going to come into crypto and they're going to bring their communities into crypto with them. We've already seen this with Gary Vee. His NFT sales platform is doing pretty well. I read recently that he's already booked $1 million in terms of, it was like volume or something. There was some metric that was important. Anyway, he's bringing his entire
clearly wasn't that important.
It was something. I can't remember. Too many numbers going on in my head. But thanks for that. Oh my God, we have a soundboard now on weekly rollups. It's gonna be my bane.
Sorry.
And only David can control it. Yeah. Talk about centralization.
See? I can keep
See
going.
What I mean? See what I deal with? Anyway. All of these influencers, If there's anyone listening still, all of these influencers will be coming to crypto and bring their communities with them. I think that's what this means. That's what Balaji's saying.
Here's another take from DCF God. He goes, this is a take on Binance and CDeFi, or really just crypto banks. He goes, Binance literally at the point where I need to upload a selfie video of myself doing random shit to get my funds. And so he is trying to withdraw his assets from Binance, and he has a withdrawal appeal page up. He has to appeal to withdraw. And here is the upload statement video instructions. You need to appear in the video and hold the information page of your ID document. Please clearly state the following. Today, on month, day, year, I'm applying to withdraw X amount of X cryptocurrency from my account. I confirm that it is my activity and I am contacting Binance customer service to enable the withdraw function of my Binance account. Here's my email address and phone number. And you have to actually do this a second time for a whole different thing. You have to do two of these things. And that sounds annoying and troublesome, especially when I compare it to just borrowing or trading or whatever on Uniswap, and all my ledger asks me is to approve a transaction or not, and it's one single button. Stark contrast. Crypto banks, not looking so hot.
Yeah, look, this is not self-sovereign finance. This
the Binance is not squeeze. Binance is getting
not
squeezed.
What we signed up for it. Look at this. I mean, this is terrible. You have to, like, record yourself saying these things, like, wow. And yeah, that this is not just for the initial signup process for AML KYC. This is just to withdraw. Every time you need to withdraw, can you imagine saying this?
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't think that's what's going on. I think if you want to withdraw, most customers can just withdraw like normally and put your Ethereum address, which is already cumbersome to begin with, because you got to check your email, like approve it, blah, blah, blah. But I think this might have happened if, like, I don't know, like his account got compromised. Either way, it's like a part of the Binance ecosystem and they're making people do it.
Uploading a video is hilarious. Yeah. All right. Balaji again.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps dropping the takes this week.
This one's completely new though. I'll read this one. Balaji goes, I'm not the first to observe this, but the speed and depth of innovation happening simultaneously in several fields is just not something that current societal institutions can handle. What Balaji is saying is there is so much innovation happening in this world, not just in crypto, but also definitely in crypto, that people just can't even come to terms with it. Like, there is massive advancements in AI. There's massive advancements in bioengineering. There's massive advancements in crypto. And Ryan, I think if you click on that text or click on that tweet, he might list, maybe it was a retweet that he retweeted himself. He just listed a bunch of things that, like, societal institutions can't handle right now because they're really complex, they're really hard to understand, and they're advancing at an accelerated rate. And so I'm just reminded of our podcast with Josh Rosenthal about the crypto renaissance. You need to be on the fringes of at least one of these fields that's about to change the world, because if you don't, then you're behind. And so be a part of the revolution, undergo the revolution rather than it happening to you. And so if you are... It would be unfortunate to be part of this legacy world and have all this massive rate of change happening that you're just ignoring because it's too complex and you can't keep up with it. Change is coming to the world. Again, this is almost completely a conversation outside of crypto. Change is coming to the world and you need to be on the ball in the 2020 decade.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't just trust your financial advisor, right? You can't just trust your college admissions officer. You can't just trust, you know, whoever's saying, if you just sock away your funds in a 401k and work at a steady job for 20 years,
right,
there's going to be like retirement.
There is no steady job for the next 20 years. One job will last for 20 years. It's going to be completely different.
Yeah. So you got to get ahead of this. This is not not the era our parents grew up in. You know, it's really cool too, as he said, current social institutions can't handle this. Crypto is a new institution. Remember when we had Balaji on, he talked about like the crypto nation state, actually creating a literal sort of nation state that is built on crypto institutions. That's the sort of thing he was talking about. If we're going to handle this rate of change, we need new institutions. Let's do this one. Why don't you read it out, David?
Yeah, okay. So this is a retweet of a Stani tweet. So it starts with the Stani saying that a kind reminder that 60% of DAI is backed by USDC, which is a little bit of a knock on DAI. Like, what good is a trustless stablecoin if 60% of it is backed by trusted collaterals, trusted assets, which is just a dollar? So DAI is...
It's a good take.
Yeah. DAI is basically 60% USDC. Is that really what we want when it comes to a trustless stablecoin? Maybe not. And then Stefan from the Rye/Reflexer project goes, another reminder that if you simply backed your pegged coin with ETH, you still have a broken peg. And so that is harking back to the days where DAI, single collateral DAI, or back when multi-collateral DAI was largely just ETH, DAI had a lot of trouble maintaining the peg. It fluctuated between 95 cents to $1.05 until they really opened up US dollar backing of DAI. And so Stefan is saying,
There's a trade-off here,
and perhaps it's actually not possible to have a pegged trustless stablecoin without compromising the composition of the collateral that is behind it. And so what the through line is, and Stefan, he's the CEO of Reflexer, so he's very incentivized to promote Rye as a product, so there's his bias there, but I still agree with him, is he's saying that perhaps the pegging is the problem. Perhaps we want a stablecoin that's unpegged, because then we can have Ether as collateral, Ether being the only collateral behind Rye, and then we have our trustless stablecoin. Maybe we just lose the peg and we keep the stability, and that's what Rye is. But whatever he's saying that, like, well, if you back DAI with centralized stablecoins, that's a problem because you're backing it with centralized stablecoins. If you back it with just ETH, well, then you lose the peg anyways because DAI... That's what Rye is doing, yeah. Yeah.
Backed by ETH,
right.
We're okay with losing the peg to the dollar. Yeah. We can create our own unit of account here.
Yeah. And so the through line is trustless stablecoins are hard. DAI has its problems and its solutions. It is still a great product. But if we really want to have the self-sovereign trustless stablecoin that we've all wanted, maybe we got to lose the peg to the dollar.
Well, it's funny too, because all the algorithmic stablecoins without collateral, without any collateral backed, have failed.
Failed. All of them so far.
They've all blown up, and they've blown up relatively quickly.
Yeah.
So maybe there's no way to solve that problem too. There's so much experimentation that goes on in the stablecoin space. I'm really excited to see all of it. How about this one? MEV negative externalities alert. This is from Robert Miller. This Polygon bot has been active since June 29th and has sent 2 million transactions, failing almost all the time. These failures cost close to nothing, but they bloat the state, while the few successes pay for the failures many times over. This is MEV at work, but on Polygon, the transactions cost almost nothing.
Right.
So it's just MEV with no cost and a lot of upside, but there is cost to the public system.
Right.
The public good that is Polygon in the form of state bloat. What's your take here?
Yeah, so there is a spectrum of scale and trade-offs, right? And so Polygon has really optimized for a very, very scaled side of this, of the scaling spectrum. And that's why Polygon transactions on Polygon are actually going to be like a lot cheaper than transactions on Arbitrum or Optimistic Rollups. Transactions on Arbitrum and Optimistic Rollups, they're going to cost like a number of pennies, up to 50 cents, maybe even up to a dollar. They will be an order of magnitude better than the Ethereum main chain, but they're not going to be free and instant. They still will be instant. They will not be free like how they are on Polygon. Polygon has scaled differently. It's made some trade-offs. It has even more scale than Optimism and Arbitrum, and then you can get even cheaper fees. But when you go that far down the spectrum of scale, then you have externalities. And so because they have made transactions so incredibly cheap, it has been economically rational for this MEV bot to spam the Polygon blockchain with random transactions, hoping one of them hits. And in the certain scenarios, that there's probably some sort of strategy that this MEV bot is trying to do, make trades on QuickSwap or something. I don't really know. It's not the point. The point is that it's economically rational for this bot to spam transactions over and over and over again, trying to like catch a fish. And every time it catches a fish, it just makes it all of the spam worth it. And this ends up just adding more and more state into the Polygon blockchain, which means that all the Polygon validators are downloading every single transaction that this bot is doing and downloading that into the state that they are downloading it. And then the whole network has to absorb all of these spam transactions because the transactions are so cheap. And so this is the MEV is causing negative externalities, which is what Robert started this tweet off, is adding bloat because of how cheap transactions are. And remember, you pay transaction fees because we need to meter resources when we use these public systems. And so the while our Polygon is so awesome because it is so incredibly scaled, it has its own network costs to this, which we are starting to see.
Yeah, yeah. State is definitely a negative externality. It's a public good that no one pays for in these chains right now. And that is the issue because it can lead to that centralization. Now, Binance Chain just like removes all the guards on this. And right. like their state has swollen, so much. I think it's
above a terabyte now.
Yeah, it's very difficult to run Binance validators, but that's of course okay. It's because there's only like 10 or 11 of them and they're all appointed by Binance. Polygon has the same issues. They have some more guardrails in place for state. And so they're limiting it in other ways. But the interesting point, I think, is that whether you're a sidechain, whether you're the main chain, Ethereum, or whether you're a layer two like Optimism or Arbitrum, you're all going to have this state bloat problem, and it's going to be a centralizing factor. Now, I'm waiting to see the first kind of iterations and changes to this. Vitalik, I don't know if you caught the post recently that Vitalik wrote, it might've been Ethereum Research, where he proposes a few solutions to Ethereum mainnet state bloat, right? One of them is this idea of like, it's not quite state rent, but it's state expiry, where like state expires after a certain point in time. Archive nodes, like distant archive nodes, can still keep it. But if you want to reactivate that state, you have to send a special transaction to reactivate that state. Mm-hmm. So that's like one idea that's floating out there. There are some other ideas as well that some of these chains have. I know when we had Arbitrum on, they talked about, some of their concepts that they were pursuing in the future. But the key thing is state can't be free. Right. In these chains. And if it is free, it'll just bloat and become centralized. So somebody has to pay for this in the future. Anyway, all these chains will have to work through it. I think Polygon will work through it as well. I think it'll be okay, but it's just a hidden cost. Somebody tweeted at me the other day, David, there's like, yeah, I'd be bullish on DeFi and crypto as soon as gas fees go away. It's like, yeah. Okay. I wouldn't.
Gas fees will go away on L2s, but like you said, I wouldn't wait until becoming bullish at that point.
But I also mean like there has to be a cost to this stuff. It can't, these transactions can't be free.
We're just used to the whole like Facebook, freemium model where we're like, oh yeah, we don't pay for our products. We just pay for them in other ways. Like you pay for them with your soul.
The product.
Yeah. Yeah. For the people who are newer into this ecosystem and want to understand why this is so important, think of state bloat as literally it's the size of the chain in like gigabyte terms. And just think about a crypto economic system that is like 20 gigabytes versus 20 terabytes. If you are only 20 gigabytes, your literal footprint on the internet is smaller and you are more anti-fragile, more spreadable, more viral.
Anybody can run it.
And more decentralized, right? And so a smaller, more lightweight system, which is what Bitcoin, when small blocks and the small block wars and the block wars for Bitcoin, that was this fight. This was this fight is can we make our blockchain crypto economic system lightweight and easy to manage? And one of the big critiques of Ethereum is that we allowed our state bloat to grow really, really quickly in the early days of Ethereum. Now we are trying to corral that. It's a big problem of crypto, but overall, we like our systems to be smaller, lighter, easier to download, easier to sync, and the more state you have, the more state bloat you have, the harder it is to achieve those goals. So there's trade-offs, balances, there's your little learning lesson.
There we go. Let's talk about this last one. So this is Jacob. Mm-hmm. Whether it's MEV performance of Uniswap V3 or economic exploits, let's take a minute to recognize that a transparent financial system means that people all around the world with nothing more than an internet connection can openly examine flaws and collectively work to resolve. Transparency is the most under-recognized property of decentralization. It is a basic requirement of decentralization. A non-transparent system can never be decentralized. And then he goes on, every critic, every troll, every diehard anti-coiner makes the system stronger. Critics can criticize precisely because the base system is transparent. regulators can call crypto a systemic risk because they can actually see how many stablecoins exist on chain. Think about how incredible it is that less than 24 hours after an exploit, there are dozens of Twitter threads, postmortems, and blog articles flush with data revealing the precise flaw. What does this look like in TradFi? A back page Bloomberg article 2 years after the event? Open public systems allow society to scale. They increase the speed and efficiency of information, coordination, collective learning, and collective resolution. I'm just going to finish this, David.
Yep.
This idea of open decentralized finance is bigger than Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Satoshi. And if preserved, if we choose to value it above all else, we'll live far beyond any implementation of it. That's a great tweet thread.
That's a great tweet thread. Yeah, I don't even have too much to add. Jacob did just a great job summarizing this. Basically, systems that are inside out have all of their flaws exposed. And so, sure, there are plenty of critiques about our industry. People critique our industry all the time. It's because it's transparent and they actually can find things to critique about. And that actually makes the system better because our flaws stick out like a sore thumb, forcing us to have to address them rather than sweep them under the rug. This is the metaphor of, Andreas Antonopoulos made this metaphor of bubble boy versus like the sewer rat, where like crypto is the sewer rat, right? Like it just eats diseases for breakfast because it's become immune to them. Whereas legacy finance is the bubble boy. Like any one little ounce of bacteria that like gets inside the bubble causes the whole system to just like die, right? And so because we are an inside out industry, we wear all of our flaws on our surface. Everyone knows what our flaws are, and we know how to answer to them and correct them and route around them. And this is why our industry is anti-fragile and why our industry is going to eat all the legacy industries. Nice.
Yep, I agree. Even like, so I've been part of some conversations about MEV and like criticisms of minor extractable, minimum extractable value on-
Maximum extractable
maximum, value. Maximum, excuse me, extractable value on Ethereum lately. And what the critics fail to recognize is that in traditional systems, right, they're extracting the value, but you just can't see it.
Right.
So there's nothing to criticize. There's no data points here. Right. Like, how do we know whether, you know, GameStop had a conversation with Citadel to halt trading or treat one group different than another? Same with Bitcoin, by the way. Like, so much activity, MEV activity in Bitcoin doesn't happen on Bitcoin. Because you can't trade on Bitcoin. You can't take out a loan on Bitcoin. What can you do on Bitcoin? You can move it from one address to another.
Yep.
All of this activity happens inside of crypto banks. Can they be front running you? Like, how about BitMEX, right? I mean, like black box derivatives model. It's so much better when all of this is upfront in the open, completely transparent. Even when we have to deal with MEV problems, at least we see what we're dealing with. That is something the critics don't take into account.
Well, that transparency with MEV really creates a completely different like context for what this industry is trying to do with MEV. Like you said, the concept or the same patterns of MEV exist in the legacy financial world. There are people who with like fiber optics cables that are measured to exactly the same as others because people want to get their trades in faster. There's order routing like deal flow. MEV in the legacy world is massive, and it's just got captured because no one really tried to collaboratively solve the problem. In the crypto world, we all see MEV and the problem that it creates, and now we are trying to collaboratively solve the problem rather than just like raising the white flag and saying, you know what, like we're just going to let some company win and capture all the value here and we'll just give up. That's what happened. We are actually, because it's transparent, we are actually trying to solve this problem and make a more equitable financial system because you can view it.
Your only choice in the legacy world, even the crypto bank world, is depend on regulators.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's how the existing system solves it. If we catch you doing something that's against the law, if we catch you, then you know you have the threat of the long arm of the law.
Yeah. You extracted $100 million from your clients, and you did it in a way that's against regulations. Here's a $5 million fine.
God, how often do bankers go to jail? Remember 2008? Zero. One guy went to jail.
One? Maybe. Oh, wow. Good, good. I'm glad we got him.
Yeah, there was a scapegoat. All right, that's it. David, let me ask you, what are you excited about this week, man?
I'm going to invoke my Anthony Sizzano here, where he tweeted out how the stars are aligning for Ethereum. And so I'm going to play off of what Anthony was saying this week. We got EIP 15599 on August 4th. We got the merge coming in Q4, Q1, 2022. Got layer two is coming in July. It's July now, by the way. We got Arbitrum and Optimism rolling out probably this month. The rebirth or renaissance of NFTs. We got institutional DeFi now. We got banks staking Ether. Like, I don't know, like, what more bullish fundamentals, like, you got want, I can ask for, but, like, I feel like I'm getting all of them. I feel like I'm getting every single bullish fundamental I've ever asked for in my time in Ethereum, and it all seems to be on the horizon. Like, that's what I'm excited about. Like, it seems to be finally here.
Yeah, dude, we definitely have a lot, and I'm going to just, what I'm excited about is I'm just going to riff on the EIP 1559, because that's something I remember when you wrote an article on Bankless 2019 called the missing puzzle piece to Ethereum's
monetary policy,
and it talked about EIP 1559. This is proof of work issuance. I'm gonna display this because
Ether's proof of work issuance.
This is Ether's proof of work issuance. I spent some time creating this, and this is annual percentage on the left axis, starting at 20% annual issuance percentage. So block time increases, issuance reduction one, issuance reduction two. And now here we are here, which is August 2021, EIP 1559 goes down. Ether is going to start to be burnt. Don't know how much. That depends on block space demand at any given time, but it's going to go down. It's going to be burnt until the merge. And then guess what? Falls off a cliff. Mm-hmm. All proof of work issuance ends. We're at about 4.2% or so annual issuance in proof of work. There's also proof of stake issuance on top of that. But all of that comes to an end. And then we get into this new era, David, this new issuance policy, monetary policy era, post EIP 1559, post the merge, which is kind of the ultrasound money era, basically, mm-hmm. where we're going to be like, less than 1% issuance, likely negative issuance for Ether for the rest of the platform's life cycle, mm-hmm. right? That's the plan right now. So I'm excited about that because EIP 1559 is the first step to ultrasound money. Get to the merge later, probably early 2022. But this first step is absolutely a monumental event in Ethereum's issuance policy, monetary policy history. It's great for ETH the asset.
Totally. This chart of Ether's issuance or Ether's monetary policy is a favorite chart of Bitcoiners to like FUD Ether as money or Ethereum's monetary policy, because they show you this chart and be like, look at how irregular this chart is. It's jagged. It's not stable. Who knows where it's going to go next? But if you look at that chart, it tells you a very, very solid trend of just a down and to the right, and also stabilizing over time. It was chaotic in the first 2 years of Ethereum. I will give you that. In 2019 onwards, it has been very stable. And it's now going into the final phases of Ethereum's monetary policy, where we just don't have to touch it forever.
It's just not even that hard to understand this issuance policy. Right. There's been like two issuance reductions, right? Mm-hmm. The places where it's gone down and risen back up have been because of a difficulty bomb that's right. been embedded in the code to force Ethereum to upgrade to get to proof of stake hard fork. When that difficulty bomb is taken away, then issuance goes back up temporarily for a period of time, but it's always down.
And it's also stabilizing over time, which is really the important thing. It is becoming exactly what Bitcoiners saying, or Bitcoin maxis say that Ether's monetary policy
is. They say it's like the Fed.
Right. It's like, which is fucking ridiculous. Excuse me. Sorry for the F word. But it's becoming more dependable, more stable over time, and importantly, extremely low. And so like this chart is, again, historically a favorite chart by Bitcoin maxis to FUD Ethereum. And I think it's about to flip into Ether people's, Ether Maxis, whatever, our favorite chart to illustrate the power of Ethereum's monetary policy. Look how low it is and look how stable it is. It's about to become a bullish ETH monetary policy chart, not a bearish one.
Minimum necessary issuance. All right, man. We promised everyone the meme of the week. Let's get to the meme of the week. What is it? Oh my gosh. What is this guy's name?
Harold. Good old Harold. Yeah, a meme favorite. And Harold's is drinking a cup of coffee, looking at his laptop, and he says, I don't want a 9-to-5 job. No one in the crypto world wants a 9-to-5 job. We want to work in crypto. So Ryan, take us to the next panel.
Oh, there's the next panel. There you go.
Now I'm in crypto. Now I work 24/7. And Ryan, you and I were talking before the show about like how we like resonate with this meme a little bit too much.
Never worked so much in my life.
I could never imagine myself going back to like a 9-to-5, like show up at 9, close it, clock out at 5 type job anymore. I don't know how I would do it. But then also I realized like, oh yeah, now I just like am not really ever turned off when it comes to working.
That is a downside, right? Not ever turned off. But like I also, when I am working, don't feel like I'm working.
Exactly.
As much. I mean, there's some things which just feel like work, but like, so it's a double-edged sword here too, but oh my God, I can relate. Like much time on crypto.
Markets don't turn off. Crypto Twitter doesn't turn off. Crypto is a global phenomenon. So announcements go out at 2 a.m, whether you are awake for them or not. And so like the overall working in the crypto industry, the lines are definitely blurred between like what is
work and play.
Yeah. Which is pros and cons. Like sometimes you just don't want to have to be working, but also it's not that bad. Also, it's just not that bad.
Yeah, that's right. You could definitely set your own schedule. Consume as much or as little as you want. All right, guys, this has been the weekly roll up. As always, none of this was financial advice. Bitcoin and ETH are risky. So is DeFi. You can lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.